I'm the writer David Sedaris. Usually we make these shows for the BBC, accompanied by 300 or so people at a theater in London. Things have been unusual this year, though, and so we're reduced to working from my home. We recorded all the actual stories in the little nook above my office, but Steve thought it would be nice to introduce each episode from a different room in my house, to make you feel at home in my home, or one of my homes. So this week, welcome to my living room, which is pretty much off limits to anyone over 5'11". The ceiling is so low, even dogs think twice before entering it. Me, I'm small, so it feels sort of perfect. Recipe for disaster. Hugh was at the New York grocery store he likes to go to when a customer in a face mask yelled at an employee to keep his 6-foot distance. "Are you serious?" I said when he told me about it. If someone's stocking shelves, if this is his workplace, I think it's your job to stay away from him and not vice versa. The following afternoon, at the sailboat pond in Central Park, we saw a woman holding out a cane with a sign taped to it. "Social distance, 6 feet, please." It was the first day of spring, and Hugh and I were seated on a bench just out of her range. I said to him, "I'm not sure she really needs the sign. I mean, brandish a cane and people are pretty much guaranteed to stay away from you." I guess she was in her late 70s, this woman. It seemed that on the off chance that this was indeed the end of the world, she had applied her entire stock of lipstick, creating a thick, multi-hued shade that might be called infected scab. Extending an arm like that for more than a few minutes is harder than it looks, so every now and then the woman would lower her cane to the ground and glare at the people approaching her. Before the shelter-at-home order was issued, we had guests over just about every night. I'd bought new clothes for my lecture tour, which had just been canceled, so would dress for dinner, thinking, well, why not? A black comme des garçons sport coat with a cascade of ruffles spilling from the hem, detachable flamenco sleeves, trousers that were pleated all the way around and made it look as though I were wearing a barrel. It was fun. Hugh and I hadn't been in our new apartment very long, and this was our first real chance to, as my mother used to say, entertain. As in, your father and I will be entertaining this Saturday night. After my parents entertained, they usually wound up sleeping in their clothes. My sisters and I would get up early the next morning and find not quite empty glasses abandoned in unexpected places. Then we would drain them. "You kids sober up and your father will drop you off at church," our mother would moan, thick-tongued and with cushion lines on her face as she staggered to the percolator. Neither Hugh nor I, together or separately, have ever gone to bed leaving a glass in the sink, much less tucked between the sofa cushions. After we got a carpet for the living room of our new apartment, it was agreed that no one could drink red wine there. So our guests tend to huddle in the kitchen, which is all marble and stainless steel and looks like the room on one of those CSI shows where you'd go to identify a body. Yes, that's my husband. The remodeling was the work of the former owners, Hughes, the cook in our household. And while the kitchen is not exactly his taste, he doesn't mind it so much. My biggest gripe is the appliances. You need an advanced engineering degree in order to operate the oven, and the glass stovetop is just as complicated. The room is filled with things that beep at you, the microwave, the electric kettle, the dishwasher, even the refrigerator, which whines incessantly if you leave the door open too long. Jesus, I say, give me a second to make up my mind, why don't you? Add the washing machine and the dryer, and it's pretty much guaranteed that something is hassling you every moment of the day. When I got an iron, not knowing it would chide me if I left it alone for 2 goddamn minutes, I said to Hugh, "I give up. From now on, I'm outsourcing our wrinkles." Then, of course, the neighborhood dry cleaner closed. The apartment is on the 19th floor. It has a dining room, and this is where I lead our guests when the food is ready. "My God," they say, admiring the beautifully set table with its cloth napkins and glowing candles. "I can't believe you just threw this together." That, again, is Hugh's doing. When I ask if we can have people over, his initial response is always the same. "Absolutely not. There's no way I'm spending all day in the kitchen." "Fine," I'll say. "Have it your way." 5 minutes later, he'll pop his head into my office. "How about lamb?" My sister Amy says that food issues have just about killed the dinner party, at least in America, and it's true. If one person is vegetarian, the next is vegan. Someone will agree to meat, but not to red meat, or only red meat if it's well done. Then there's a guy who's fine with seafood, but not octopus, because he once saw one open a jar in a YouTube video. We had a guest recently who wouldn't eat any animal that was cute, which really is up to interpretation. I mean, how adorable is a duckling when you're the tadpole it's about to tuck into? Most people say, "Go ahead and serve what you were going to. I'll just eat around it." But you don't want someone with nothing but salad on his plate, trying to pick the snap peas out because he's fructose intolerant. This is exactly why we don't have children over. "I only eat white things," kids will say, or, "The chicken touched the carrot, so I'm not having any of it." Now their parents are the same way. In the early days of the coronavirus, it was nothing to have 10 people over. The deaths in China were talked about, as well as the worsening situations in Iran and Italy. I recall one night when Hugh shared an email he'd received. It was secondhand, supposedly from a British doctor who'd flown to Wuhan at the start of the outbreak and had inside information on how to combat it. One of the tips was to drink plenty of hot liquids, green or black or herbal tea, because the heat would kill the virus. "That is complete nonsense," I said. "I mean, who drinks more hot tea than the Chinese? And it's certainly not stopping anything there." The email also claimed that if you could hold your breath and count to 10, you definitely didn't have COVID-19. Hugh's acupuncturist was spreading the same misinformation. "You just don't believe in acupuncture," he said at the table when I expressed my doubt. This, I explained to our guests, is the same woman who thinks MS is a self-inflicted illness brought on themselves by people who can't make up their minds. I mean, really, allow an idea like that to take root and you're no better than the ones drinking bleach, which you could still find back then, in the early days. Then the virus spread to America. When it was officially labeled a pandemic, people started staying home and not leaving unless they absolutely had to. We could still count on my sister Amy for dinner, though, and on Hugh's nephew, Charles, who was 25 and who had moved to New York a few months earlier. My elegantly dressed agent, Christina, was usually game as well. She lived only a few blocks away, so getting home afterward was easy, even in the high heels she likes to wear. For Amy, it was more difficult. When cabs disappeared the third week of March, she'd walk from her place in the West Village to ours in the East 60s, a distance of 53 blocks. That was fine at 7 o'clock, but spooky at midnight when the streets were deserted. Normally in New York City, one out of every 500 people you pass is crazy. Now it was one out of every two. I'm thinking of the red-faced man who held $3 in his hand and yelled, when I noticed him counting it, "Don't be looking at my money, bitch!" Then he turned his right hand into a pistol and pretended to shoot me in the head. "Over $3?" I said. As our dinners continued, the rules became more lax. Hugh and I are normally pretty strict with each other regarding what one can and cannot do at the table. Suddenly, phones, which were never allowed under any circumstances, started making inroads. There was a lot of false information coming in. "Trump just said people are dying who have never died before," someone would say, looking up from a text or a tweet. "He just called it the Kung Flu at a press conference." Though both sounded completely plausible, only the second was true. Then there were the memes and videos. I can go weeks without looking at YouTube. As with Instagram, I'll forget it exists. Then something will prompt me, and I'll make up for lost time. For some reason, in late March, I couldn't stop watching purse snatchings. "Look at this," I'd say to Amy, our dinner plate still in front of us. The guy comes up from behind this woman while she's paying for gas. She refuses to surrender her pocketbook, so he drags her to the front of the store where he starts kicking her. I also got interested in chimpanzees killing and eating monkeys. There are any number of videos on the subject, all of them gruesome, but completely fascinating. The hunting is done in a pack, and each chimp has his job. One blocks, one herds the prey, and another captures it high up in a tree. Then they unite and literally tear the monkey from limb to limb while it's still alive. This while other members of their troop stand on the ground below them and cheer, waiting for whatever foot or finger or ragged scrap of forehead they might be awarded after the first three hunters take the choicest bits. "You savages," I said the first time I saw this. "Enough," Hugh shouted, on or about the third time I played one of these videos. He had a pet monkey when he was a child, so I switched back to purse snatchings until Amy commandeered the iPad to show me a video of Madonna sitting in a tub filled with rose petals. Her face looked as if she'd been stung by 100 bees, so at first I didn't recognize her. "That's something I hadn't thought of," I said. "What's going to happen when celebrities can no longer get Botox injections, when they can't get filler or have their hair dyed? Come Easter, poor Cher is going to look like Ken Livingston." When Hugh and I last lived in New York, we were in Soho, in a fourth-floor walk-up. Our apartment was in the back of the building, but still I was bothered by the din of the traffic, specifically people honking. In the new place, I find that I like the sounds of congestion. High up, the car horns and sirens are muffled, a gentle reminder that we live in a city. I like the sight of the traffic as well, this glittering necklace snaking up and down the avenues. As the shelter-at-home mandate continued, the traffic disappeared, as did the construction on neighboring buildings. Now it was actually quieter in New York than it had been in our house in England, where we'd at least hear birds and the bleating of future lamb chops. I went to the Union Square Farmers Market one afternoon, not because I needed anything, but because I was grateful that it was still open. "Keep a 6-foot distance," a goon in a hooded sweatshirt barked when I saw Christina and stepped up to join her at a stand that sold water buffalo. I hate being treated like Rip Van Winkle, as though I'd just woke from a 20-year nap and don't know what the new rules are. "We're together," I told the guy, who glared at me, uncertain. On a whim, I bought goat meat, which Hugh decided might work in a curry. A few days later, I returned to the market alone and looked more closely at the groundwater buffalo, thinking, "What can you make out of it?" I asked the fellow on the other side of the card table. He adjusted his mask. "Anything, really. Use your imagination." That night, we invited Amy, Charles, and Christina for dinner. They basically don't spend time with anyone but us. We're masked and gloved when out in the world, so how is our group any more dangerous than a family? Some co-ops are no longer allowing visitors. It's bound to happen in our building as well. Every time I turn around, there's another sign in the elevator. "No workmen, no housekeepers or personal assistants, no furniture deliveries." Every day, the noose tightens. Soon, it will just be me and Hugh, covered in cobwebs. But in the meantime, there are glasses to fill and guests to be attended to. We'll eat and make merry as the virus rages on and the leftover water buffalo enchiladas slowly harden in the burnished, morgue-like kitchen. I think people who put fingernail polish on in public places are just the worst people ever. Nailed. I'd boarded the Eurostar from London to Paris, and we had just left the station when the English woman across the aisle began applying nail polish. "Tell me you're kidding," I said. She was in her late 60s, sitting with her husband, who wore shorts and had a long pink face, That's like using spray paint on a train, I continued. It would be different if the windows opened, but they don't, and it's giving me a headache. I've only just unscrewed the cap, the woman said. You honestly expect me to believe that it's affected you this quickly? Yes, I told her. I'm begging you to stop. She said she would, and then she continued. So you're going to stop when you're finished? Is that it? I asked. For God's sake, man, her husband said, looking up from his phone. We have to be on this train together for 2.5 hours. I'm aware of that, I told him, watching as his wife screwed the lid back on. The polish was cantaloupe-colored and matched her face and her short dyed hair. If you've got a headache, take a paracetamol, the husband said. He wasn't as involved as his wife wanted him to be. He wasn't chivalrous, just tired-sounding. I guess you could say I won, but it was a hollow victory. I don't know what it is with me and nail polish. The smell goes right to my nervous system. I've never seen a French woman do her nails on a train. Rather, she's always British. Do they not smell it, I wonder? Once a woman seated beside me in a London restaurant did it. Oh, no, you don't, I said. And she acted as if I'd asked her not to chew her food, as if my request was completely unreasonable. Is this my punishment for smoking all those years, I wondered. I took out my laptop and had just started working when I heard the woman say to her husband, the sound of his typing is giving me a headache. What about that? What about me being bothered? She's got to be kidding, I thought. How can she even hear me? His fingers striking the keys. It's driving me crazy. She was, of course, just trying to get me back. If she'd taken her case to me, though, wouldn't I have had to accept it and quit typing just as she had to quit painting her nails? Then I'd have to insist that her breathing was bothering me, and it would just escalate until we were both dead, and it was just her husband seated between us, happy at last. Must everything go? I used to believe that an old person, someone who was, say, 62, would give anything to be young again. Not just to look 20, but to be 20. Only now do I realize how wrong I was. While I wouldn't mind an unshriveled face and a full head of hair, wouldn't mind new feet, as my current ones are as misshapen and startling as a hobbit's, I'd still want to be dead by 2045 at the very latest. Because I just don't think I can handle that much more change. I lose patience with my 96-year-old father sometimes, with his crabbiness and refusal to just get on with it, for God's sakes. Then I remember that when he was young, you could still run into a Civil War veteran. There were still horses on the streets, and things worth having that could be bought with a nickel. I sound as old as he does when I tell my niece that we had only one phone in our house and that it was attached to the wall. When I say that our teachers were allowed to hit us, then send us home to our parents who would take it a step further and beat us until we bled. One change I cannot bear, and which has really gotten out of hand this past decade, is the rise of e-commerce, or, more specifically, its effect on brick-and-mortar stores, which are rapidly disappearing. If I can't shop, and I mean really shop, like walk into an actual place and come out 20 minutes later with a bag under my arm, hating myself for buying something I know I'll never wear outside the house, I don't know who I am. I watch as storefronts and towns and cities get plastered over with for lease signs, and my heart sinks. Even if it's a place I disagreed with, a chain selling knockoff designer wear made by children standing in mud, hell, the closing of a Nazi supply store would bother me at this point. Oh no, not them too, I'd cry, peering through the window at the shambles within. Don't all empty stores look like the owners were forced to evacuate with only 5 minutes' notice? Aside from the vacant shop fronts, I worry about the sales clerks and cashiers. Don't we owe them something? At the supermarket I go to in West Sussex, they've recently installed a number of those self-checkout kiosks. I look at the people using them and think, honestly? As long as there are still a few humans behind the registers, and really nice ones we've all known for years, why would you use a machine? Sarah with the new husband, Corrine, who's terrified of bees. How can you willfully put these people out of work? I asked a woman ahead of me in line a few months back why she was choosing the human instead of the self-checks, and she said, oh, the queues there are too long. So if they were shorter, you'd use them? She nodded yes, yet I noticed how chatty she was with the cashier. Hi, Wilfred, how are you keeping? Does she not connect the machine to the future of the person she's talking to? Another problem with the self-checkouts is that they're silent. I like passing time with cashiers, always have, and I hold those customers who undergo a transaction while talking on their phones in very low regard. Are you kidding? Said a friend when I chided him for looking at Facebook while his groceries were being rung up. My phone is my shield. It saves me from having to make small talk, which I hate. I don't like it either, I told him, but it doesn't have to be that way. No one's forcing you to bring up the weather. Take a real interest. Use some imagination. Has anyone ever vomited on your conveyor belt? I'll often ask. That always works in the UK, but there are 1,000 decent questions. Do you have any friends in wheelchairs? Have you ever had your pupils dilated? Should we believe what they say about blanks giving us cancer? This is ever-changing, as every day brings some new study, fir trees, support animals, peppermint soap, just read the paper. I've been told that as the self-check machines take over, the cashiers will be reassigned to stock work, which I don't believe for 1 minute. Half these people are my age and wear slip-on shoes for the exact same reason that I do. They can't bend over without crying. So how are they going to stack heavy bags of cat litter on a bottom shelf? I've seen the self-check machines in U.S. drugstores and supermarkets, in Canada and throughout Europe. Strangely, though, I've never seen one in Japan. People tend to think of that country as super modern, but it's the only place I regularly visit without shuttered storefronts. While American businesses are beholden only to their stockholders, Japanese ones still seem to care about their workers. Walk into a coffee shop in Tokyo or Osaka, and there are always 8 employees behind the counter, 6 seemingly hired just to shriek, "Welcome!" as you walk through the door. Every business seems overstaffed there, all except a store I've been going to for years where everything on sale is shaped like a mushroom. There they manage with just one clerk, who I'm guessing is also the owner. She brightens every time my sister and I walk in, perhaps because we're the only customers she's ever had. In the West, though, it's survival of the fittest. The stores that have managed to hang on in New York are seriously kissing their customers' asses now. Can I get you a cappuccino while you shop? How about a soda or some sparkling water? You'd think this would make a shopper feel appreciated, but oddly, it seems to have the opposite effect. A cappuccino, is that all? Where's my discount? My foot rub? The offer of a date with the best looking of your cousins? Making everything just that much worse is social media. The bad Yelp review because the salesperson glanced at her nails as you told her you could buy whatever she's selling much cheaper online. The vengeful tweet because the store was out of your size. That's the most destructive machine of all, the computer. It got worse still when it shrunk down to a phone and they stuck a camera on it. For 35 years, my best friend Ronnie has managed a shoe store in San Francisco. It used to mint money. Now people come in and ask if she's got a particular style in a size 6. She'll fetch it, the customer will try it on, and then ask if there's a 6.5. Let me check, Ronnie will say. She'll run into the stockroom, hoist her 63-year-old body up a ladder, find the 6.5, and return. Size-wise, a new shoe is perfect. The issue now is the color. Does this possibly come in black? Back in the stockroom, then to the customer who'll try on the black and stand before the mirror for a while, doing that thing with her face, even though the mirror only shows her from the knees down. Now this is good, she'll purr. This is what I'm talking about. So how would you like to pay? Ronnie will ask. Oh, the person will say, I'm going to get it online. I just wanted to check on the fit. Why did you even tell me that? Ronnie will ask. Then she'll get a bad review on Yelp for being snippy. Go into a bookstore anymore and all you see are people taking photos of things they'll order on Amazon now that they've skimmed the first paragraph or felt the novel's weight in their hands. I said to a clerk at the Tattered Cover in Denver not long ago, "The thing is that they're so shameless about it." "I know," he said. "The least they could do is type the title into their phone, but they're too lazy to do even that." I want to ask these online shoppers, what are you going to do in 2030 when all the stores and businesses are gone? You'll have the money you saved by buying things on Amazon, an extra $3 here or 75 cents there. But you'll also maybe have a gastrointestinal virus or irritable bowel syndrome. You'll be out on Main Street or Madison Avenue, willing to trade anything for a toilet. But oops, that was in the shuttered department store or the hotel that's gone now because everyone books rooms on Airbnb. The good news, I suppose, is that after you soil your trousers, you can pull out your phone, order a new pair, and have them delivered the very next day, right to your door. And it's such a good price. How clever you are. What do you know? It's things from my diary. March 29th, 2019, New York. I stopped at the Apple store on Prince Street yesterday for an external hard drive I can use to back up my laptop. The salesman, who was young and bearded, dressed like all his associates in jeans and a t-shirt, was running my card through his machine when I looked across the room at a woman in her 80s. She wore a wide-brimmed black hat and had socks with bright flowers on them. Everything in between was beautiful and interesting, all items a witch would wear, but updated slightly. "God," I said, "doesn't that woman look fantastic?" The salesman followed my gaze. "You should go for it," he said. "I beg your pardon? Walk over and chat her up," he told me. "I didn't mean that way," I said, wondering how old he thought I was. I mean, she had to have at least 20 years on me. April 27th, 2019, Tallahassee, Florida. At last night's signing, I met a woman named Darby who was nosing around online recently and found a notice reading, "To the person who stole my antidepressants, I hope you're happy." Thank you for listening to the show. Everything today was written and read by me, David Sedaris. The producer is Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for BBC Radio 4.
And we'll join David Sedaris for...